It seems like enough. I can survive if I keep the sleep schedule as it has been constructed for me. But if it seems my reflexes are delayed, or if I sway when I walk, or weep, or do not weep, please don't worry. I'm not under destruction. My grief has cast me in a lethargic cabaret, so pay the cover charge and take your seat. This morning has become a relentless production, and I've got 78 roles to play. Chapter 84. Assimilation. Driving in the Cascade foothills, I stop for the deer that had already stopped for me. Growing up on the reservation by choice and desperation, we ate almost every animal that walked, swam, or flew. In my res youth, I would have seen that roadside deer and thought, food. In my urban adulthood, I saw that deer and talked to him. I rolled down my window and said, "You are way too tame, Mr. Four Point. Somebody is gonna shoot your ass." Chapter 85. Litmus Test. After reading my stories and poems, people often ask me, "Why did your father drink so much?" But some strangers, the ones who know the most about pain, hear my father's tragic story and they ask, "Damn. Why didn't he drink more?" Chapter 86. Standardized Achievement. I wonder if my mother is at rest or if she's laughing at her bequest, a rigorous 78-question test that quantifies our devotion and grief. This test will be proctored by a machine that thinks slight misdeed and fucking stampede of maternal rage horses are synonyms. Or maybe everyone sits for this quiz and writes long essays about phantom limbs and how we children ache in that place. Now sterilized and amputated, where our good and bad mothers graced. Chapter 87. Everything you need to know about being Indigenous in America. In August 2015, as a huge forest fire burned on my reservation, as it burned within feet of the abandoned uranium mine, the United States government sent a representative to conduct a town hall to address the growing concerns and fears. My sister texted me the play-by-play of the meeting. "OMG," she texted. "The government guy just said the USA doesn't believe the forest fire presents a serious danger to the Spokane Indian community, even if the fire burns right through the uranium mine." Chapter 88. Fire. In August 2015, a forest fire burned nearly 40,000 acres on my reservation in eastern Washington state. Over 300 miles away, in Seattle, I was able to log on to a U.S. Forest Service website and watch satellite images of that growing fire. Updated regularly, the images were snapshots of destruction. I was afraid for my siblings living only a few miles from the southern edge of that blaze. "We've been ordered to prepare for evacuation," my sister texted me. "We've loaded up the two cars with the most important stuff." "What stuff?" I texted back. "All the photo albums," she texted, "and all the beaded stuff, and quilts, and the jewelry, and everybody's powwow regalia, and the Indian paintings." "Good," I texted back. It had only been a few weeks since our mother died, since grief had started a flash fire in our bones, And now my brothers and sisters were facing another fire, which threatened to burn everything else. "Can you see the fire?" I texted my sister. "We can see huge smoke clouds on the horizon," she texted. "The sky and the smoke are glowing orange." "Reflecting the fire, probably," I texted. "Yes," she texted. "It is scary and beautiful." Grief is scary and beautiful too, I thought, but did not text. I wondered if you can look at smoke clouds and see objects and animals like you can do with regular clouds floating in the sky. I wondered if I had been standing beside my sister, if I would have seen our late mother's face in the smoke. Yes. 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 I would have forced myself to see her in the smoke. I would have invented her face. And thinking of my mother's face made me think of the paintings of Indian faces hanging on the walls of my childhood home. "The paintings you put in the car?" I texted my sister. "You mean the ones Dad bought?" "Yes," my sister texted. I laughed. My father's paintings were cheap shopping mall art that depicted wise Indians in eagle feather headdresses floating majestically over golden desert landscapes. My sisters had packed those corny paintings in their cars along with family and tribal heirlooms that would fit beautifully in any Native American museum. I laughed at the dichotomy between Indian art and Indian kitsch. And then I laughed at us, the Indians, who were equally in love with that same art and kitsch. I laughed because I would have saved those silly paintings too. "Is the air okay?" I texted. "It hurts a little to breathe," my sister texted back. "But we're okay." Jesus, I thought, is there a better and more succinct definition of grief than "it hurts a little to breathe, but we're okay"? "If you have to evacuate, where will you stay?" I texted. "They have shelters in Reardon and Airway Heights," my sister texted back. "No," I texted. "Just call me if they make you evacuate and I'll get you hotel rooms with kitchens." "Okay," she texted. "Thank you." Over the years, I'd often had to give money to my parents and siblings to save them from their own bad decisions. And I'd often been angry about my family's irresponsibility and would then feel guilty for harshly judging my loved ones. After all, wasn't I the fucking progressive indigenous leftist who believed that every American should be guaranteed a minimum basic income? If I didn't happily help provide for at least some of my siblings' basic needs, then didn't that make me a bad liberal and worse Indian? But hey, I felt no conflict in offering to shelter my siblings and the good and bad Indian art in a clean and decent hotel if they had to evacuate our reservation. Their lives were on fire. Hell, sometimes it feels like the whole country is on fire. Like a constant conflagration is burning too close to all poor people. Shouldn't rich-ass America be taking care of everybody? "How many people are fighting the fire?" I texted my sister. "About 200 Spokane Indians," she texted, "and maybe 100 Indians from other reservations." "Is the government sending in their firefighters?" "They said they're low on resources, low on men and equipment. They don't know when they'll be able to send more help." I briefly fantasized about driving to the res to help fight the blaze. I would extinguish it all by myself. I'd blow out the flames with my epic and poetic breath like I was an Indian X-Man mutant. In reality, I knew I would throw out my bad back after scooping up maybe the 6th shovelful of dirt and ash. Then some Indian or Indians would have to carry my sad sack ass away from the fire line. "Jerry, Tinker, and Steve are cutting fire breaks with their tractors," my sister texted. They were cousins, very good friends with my big brother, but distant to me. I was proud to hear of their courage. They were blue-collar Indians. Their hands were calloused from years of hard work. My hands are writer smooth. My late mother's hands were often rough for manual labor. She sold her quilts mostly to white people and sometimes to other Indians. During my childhood, for months at a time, my mother's quilt money was our minimum basic income. "I'm scared of fire," I texted my sister. "Me too," she texted back. My siblings and I have been afraid of flames ever since our big sister died in a trailer fire. I don't have to imagine her face when I stare into a fire. My dead sister's face screams at me from every fire, from the small embers of lit cigarettes to the massive fireworks shows in Seattle every 4th of July and New Year's Eve. Looking at those satellite images of that forest fire on my reservation, I could see that it was burning closer and closer to the abandoned uranium mine. Yes, that out-of-control forest fire was threatening to turn the abandoned uranium mine into Dante's Resferno. That might be all you need to know about Native American history. Or maybe you just need to know that my tribe survived that forest fire, and survived the much larger forest fire that burned a year later. We Indians know how to survive every fire. Chapter 89, Love Story. My maternal grandfather, James Cox, Spokane Indian and Scottish, died 6 years before I was born. My paternal grandmother and grandfather, Susan and Adolph Alexi, Coeur d'Alene Indians, both died 20 years before I was born. My maternal grandmother, Etta Adams, Spokane, died when I was 14. So 75% of my direct connection to ancestral culture and history was gone before I was born. And 100% of that direct connection disappeared before I had a driver's license. My mother and father taught me more about modern Indian powwows and Indian basketball than they did about ancient tribal practices and beliefs. Much more. Well, to be specific, my mother taught my sisters how to be powwow fanatics, and my father taught basketball to my brothers and me. My parents sometimes talked about their autobiographical histories. But in telling their stories, my mother often aggressively lied, and my father often passively omitted key details. I think they both sought to disguise and hide their trauma. Until I began writing this book and doing some fairly basic genealogical research, I didn't know that my father had uncles and aunts who died young. I had no inkling of any of this until I stood in Sacred Heart Mission Cemetery on the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation and saw the grave of a man named Edward Alexi. "Who is Edward Alexi?" I texted my sister. "Some relative, I guess," my sister texted back. At Edward's graveside, I pulled out my iPad and did some quick research on him. Though I am half Coeur d'Alene through my father, I didn't grow up on that reservation. Culturally speaking, I am Spokane. So my knowledge of day-to-day Coeur d'Alene life is limited. I have family and friends on the CDA res, but I see them only occasionally. And after reading only a few documents, I called my sis. I needed to say more than texting would allow. "Edward was Dad's uncle," I said. "He died the same year that Dad was born." "What did he die of?" my sister asked. "Smallpox, bubonic plague, Custer's ghost, I don't know," I said. "I'm an Indian, on an iPad, in an Indian cemetery with access to all the information on the internet. But I can't find his cause of death." "Why don't you call somebody with the Coeur d'Alene tribe, a historian or somebody, or be really crazy and ask one of our cousins what they know?" "I can't," I said. "I'm too embarrassed to let them know how much I don't know." "They're sure gonna find out how much you didn't know when you publish your book," I laughed. "This memoir," I said, "is gonna have a lot of blank space. I suppose I could really dig into the research and get stuff as accurate as possible, but I like the blank spaces. I like how they feel. I want my readers to feel how I feel. I want them to feel the loss, to feel our loss. I want them to know how guilty I feel for not knowing this stuff. It's not your fault, my sister said. Dad never talked about bad things. And Mom lied so much, I said. Yes, she did, my sister said and laughed. Just like you? I laughed. Okay, I said. I gotta do more research. I think nearly all of my father's uncles and aunts and his mother and father died young. One aunt named Mary Magdalene Alexei, Magdalene spelled M-A-G-D-O-L-I-N-E, was 5 years old when she died on January 16, 1911. I don't know if her misspelled middle name was a typo on the official records or if it was misspelled on purpose by her parents. 2 days after Mary Magdalene's death, Eugene Burton Ely landed his plane on the deck of the USS Pennsylvania in San Francisco Bay. That was the first time an airplane landed on a ship. My father's other aunt, Mary Catherine Alexei, was only a year old when she died on April 11, 1911. 6 days after Mary Catherine's death, Southern Methodist University was chartered. So yes, while my great-aunts were dying young on the res, some incredible things were happening in the outside world. I can't find any evidence of where my great-aunts are buried. I don't know why they died. Were they buried in the old Coeur d'Alene way? Were they wrapped in blankets and placed in graves dug by their parents? I know those graves, unmarked and forgotten, must be located somewhere on my father's reservation. Probably close to the town Dismet, Idaho, where they were born. But that town is surrounded by wheat fields now. So did my great aunts long ago become part of a harvest? Did they help wheat to grow? Did my great aunts become bread? I don't know. I don't know. There is another Mary Alexei. She was my father's great aunt and lived until 1982. Early census reports have her listed as Mary Agatha Alexei, though her gravestone reads Mary Agathe Alexei, dropping the third A from Agatha. So which is mistaken? The early census reports or the gravestone? Has to be the gravestone that's correct, right? But I don't know for certain. I don't know. During my childhood, my father would often take me on long drives around his reservation. He'd mostly tell me stories about his athletic successes and failures. Sometimes, my father would park on the shoulder of a resback road, a dirt and gravel one-lane history book, and then he'd stare out the window and remember things that he never shared with me. He'd gently ignore me. He wanted me to travel with him. He wanted my presence, but not my words. So I gently ignore him back and read my books and comic books. On those road trips, my father would sometimes visit his great aunt Mary Agathe or Agatha Alexei, but I'd stay in the car. She looked so old that it was intimidating. As a child, I didn't have the words to describe what Great Aunt Mary evoked in me. But now I think it was something like, holy shit, I am never, not once in my life, gonna be as Indian as that Indian is Indian. I worried she might be a ghost. That was irrational, I know, but my father spent part of his childhood among Indians who were alive when Custer and Crazy Horse were battling each other. My father was alive on the reservation with a few old Coeur d'Alene Indians who had gone to war against George Wright and the 9th U.S. Cavalry. My father toddled among indigenous warriors who had shot arrows at white soldiers. There is a photo of my father with his mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. In the absence of my father's stories, of his personal oral tradition, I only have photographs like this. I have studied it for hours. I love most the expression of my father's mother's face. Susan Alexei, the grandmother I never knew. so she's more like a stranger. No, that's not the right word. She's more like an idea. She's the idea of a grandmother. She is pregnant with my Aunt Ellen, who would die of diabetes during my first year at Reardon. But in that old photo, my grandmother appears to be looking at something or someone at a frame. Not her husband, since he was already serving in the U.S. Army. Whom is she looking at? And what is that expression on her face? Amusement? Suspicion? Irritation? Shyness? She is the indigenous Mona Lisa. Susan Alexie died of tuberculosis on August 30th, 1945. I don't know why the exact date of her death is not on her gravestone. Perhaps it had been about money. Those extra letters and numbers might have been too expensive. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I could write "I don't know" 1,000,000 times and publish that as my memoir. And yes, it would be repetitive, experimental, and more metaphor than history. But it would also be emotionally accurate. My father was only 6 years old when his mother and father died. I'd love to think that he didn't remember his parents, that time had erased his memory. But I can remember things that happened to me when I was only 6, and it's not the good stuff that I recall. No. It's the most traumatic shit that plays in the 3D IMAX theater of my mind. So I know that my father remembered his dead parents. But he never said one word to me about them. Not ever. Chapter 90. Genocide. Grief is a sea creature. A predator newly discovered. Or so you believe. Until you remember, genetically, that this same grief hunted your mother, and your father, and your grandparents, and all of the women and men who created you. What happens to humans who live as prey? We are furious. Furious, furious, and afraid. Chapter 91. Reprise. The United States did not believe the forest fire burning through the uranium mine presented any danger to the Spokane Indian community. Chapter 92. Rollerball. I saw your mom yesterday, Purnell said. At church? So? I asked. Purnell was a nice Indian boy. He'd always been kind to me. We were reservation sixth graders who'd never punched each other. That qualified as a close friendship. Some people called him Jack. I sometimes called him Jack, too. I have no idea how a kid ends up being named Jack and Purnell. And no, Purnell wasn't his last name, and I don't think his middle name was Jack or Purnell. Your mom sang a solo in the choir, Purnell said. She sings really good. My mother had a lovely singing voice, but I'd only heard her singing along with her favorite country songs or with Elvis. I'd rarely heard her sing any Christian spirituals because I'd never gone to church with her. She never asked or forced us kids to go to any of the various Christian churches she'd attended over the years. Inside our family, we children were allowed to practice the religion of our choice. I was vaguely Catholic for a time, then became an Assembly of God kid in order to romantically pursue a white girl from a little white town. She rejected me, so I quit going to that church. I quit all churches, white, native, or anything else. Like most Indians nationwide, my sisters turned the powwow into their sole spiritual pursuit. My big brother has never made any declaration of faith. And my little brother became a fundamentalist Christian after marrying into a white evangelical family. Our father was a childhood Catholic who spent his adulthood using vodka and fiery chili as his only Eucharist. And now, as I write this, I realize that I'd rarely heard my mother sing any traditional Spokane songs, neither the former religious hymns or the casual stick game gambling songs. She was always on the powwow trail, traveling from reservation to reservation to watch the dancers and drummers. But she didn't sing along. Or maybe she did sing along. I don't know. I rarely traveled to powwows with her. I was too busy playing basketball and reading books. Spiritually speaking, my mother was as unknowable to me as any of her gods. And then, after your mom was done singing in the choir, Purnell said, I saw your mom rolling in the aisle and speaking in tongues. No way, I said. She was probably just speaking Spokane. My mother was one of the few tribal members who were still fluent in the old way of speaking Spokane. It wasn't Indian talk, Purnell said. It was their Jesus voice. There were quite a few Spokane Indians who fell in love with Pentecostal and charismatic Christianity. I think it's rather easy for a universally damaged people like Native Americans to believe wholeheartedly in miracles, in the supernatural. But I'd never thought of my mother as a Spokane who'd go that far. I'm not lying, Purnell said. I believe you, Jack, I said, though I hoped he was mistaken. When I got home from school, I immediately asked my mother if she'd been speaking in tongues. Yes, she said. Weird, I said, and walked downstairs to my room. I figured my mother was pretending to speak in tongues. She was just acting, I thought. It's like a one-woman show, I guessed. My mother had always been so dramatic. And what's more dramatic than an Indian woman rolling down the aisle of a little reservation church? I tried to put it out of my mind, to allow my mother to freely practice her religion as much as she allowed me to fully practice my non-religion. But a few weeks later, I crawled out of my Sunday morning slumber and walked the mile to her church. And there she was, along with the white couple who led the church and a few dozen Spokane Indians, throwing books, magazines, and music albums onto a bonfire. My mother and her fellow indigenous charismatics were chanting something about the devil, about the evil of the secular world, about all the sin-soaked novels and porn magazines and rock music. I was grossed out. On opposite sides of the bonfire, my mother and I made eye contact. But I think she was so deeply entranced, so hypnotized and self-hypnotized, that she didn't recognize me. I hurried home to make sure my small personal library of books and records was intact and unburned. And yes, all was safe. Later that night, at the dinner table, I told my mother to leave my stuff alone, or I'd burn down her church. You're a sinner, she said, and pointed her fork at me. And so are you, I said, and pointed my fork right back at her. Chapter 93 Law and Order. Hey, shithead. If you're going to forgive your mother, then you better hurry. But hold on. Maybe you can delay because you're the judge and one-man jury and all of the lawyers and bailiffs. Hell, you're the Bible and the ornate gavel. Most of all, you're the journalist who opines about justice kept whole or justice unraveled. Hey, shithead, you've never worn a watch, so I suspect this case will become eternal. As you try and try and try your mother for the crime of being unpredictably maternal. Chapter 94. The Lily and Alexei Review of Books. My late mother was once interviewed by the local news about her son, me, the poet. When asked if she knew that I would become a writer, she said, "I thought he was going to be a pediatrician. There's still time for him to become a doctor, I think." She was also asked if it hurt to read my most autobiographical stuff, the shit that detailed how she used to drink and smoke and punch old Indian women in the face. She said, "I was ashamed and wished to use fake names. But then I realized they made me think honestly about the past." I don't know if she was telling the truth. She mythologized herself as much as I do. But I can testify to this. Whenever I traveled near home to read my poems, my mother would always sit in the third row and gracefully withstand my utter lack of tact. Though, on the phone, she once described me as 13% book smart and 87% dick jokes. Ah, the things our mothers know. Chapter 95. Painkiller. My sister reminds me of the time that I stepped on a nail, screamed in pain, and ran with the nail and board still attached to my foot. Also screaming, our mother chased me wanting to deliver first aid, but I was probably trying to elude the pain by running from everything in the world. When she finally caught me, my mother pushed me down, pulled the nail and board off my foot, and then removed my shoe. We all expected to see blood, but no, 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 the nail had miraculously passed between my toes with barely a scratch. That nail had been impaled in my shoe and not in my foot. We laughed, and Mom asked me why I was screaming from pain when there was no pain. I had no answer then. But now I think that I'd been anticipating the pain, much like the rain dancer who is always successful because he doesn't stop dancing and praying and dancing and praying until it rains and rains and rains and rains. Chapter 96. Cultural Identity. 15 years ago, at a book reading in Philadelphia, a white man asked me what made my work so particularly Indian. He said that my poems and stories didn't seem all that Indian. I said, "First of all, you're a white guy from Philadelphia. What do you know about Indians you didn't learn from some other white guy from Philadelphia? And secondly, would you ask a white guy what makes him so white? Well, let me tell you, pal, that question you just asked makes you the whitest asshole in Philadelphia right now." Yes, before I went on bipolar medication, I would sometimes lose my temper in very public and aggressive and completely justified ways. But as the years have gone by, I've often pondered that white man's question. And I often think of the other white people and Indians who have questioned the Indianness of my identity. And I have experimented with various answers to their questions and challenges. I have considered the genetic, cultural, political, spiritual, and economic aspects of Indianness. I have discussed the issue with other indigenous writers and scholars. I have read millions of words written by and about Indians. So, if I could travel back in time to Philadelphia, I would answer that white man's question in a different way. I would have said, "The concept of Indianness is amorphous and highly personal and eccentric. It's hard to say exactly what Indianness is without reverting to generic notions of cultural construction and post-colonialism, but I will say that I have never been a dancer or singer. I have only intermittently believed in God. I used to be a math prodigy, and now I'm a great storyteller. Does any of that make me more or less Indian? I don't think so. You know what makes me and my stories Indian? All the goddamn funerals. At that point, I'm sure that white man would have been trying to speak again, so I would have stepped forward and said, "You know what also makes me Indian? I could punch you in the face right now, do an improvised 30-minute lecture on the sonnet poetry form, and then punch you again. And hell, you might be a professional boxer who will kick my ass, but that doesn't matter to me as an Indian. I will fight you even if I absolutely know I'm going to lose. You could knock me out and I could wake up and still deliver that 30-minute lecture on the sonnet with a heavy-duty reservation accent. I mean, dude, I come from an honor culture. Do you know what that entails?" And then, as a sort of concluding couplet, I would have added, "And also, in case you missed the subtext, in case you misheard, then let me say, fuck off, you colonial turd." Chapter 97, Motherland. I tend to believe in government, because it was the U.S. government that paid for my brain surgery when I was 5 months old, and provided USDA food so I wouldn't starve during my poverty-crushed reservation childhood, and built the HUD house that kept us warm, and gave me scholarship money for the college education that freed me. Of course, the government only gave me all of that good shit because they completely fucked over my great-grandparents and grandparents, but, you know, at least some official white folks keep some of their promises. Chapter 98, Glacial Pace. When I was 13, I coughed on some ice chips, and my mother quickly rose and belted me hard on the back 1, 2, 3, 4 times. Later I said, "Mom, it was ice. It was gonna melt." I was angry at her, maybe because I needed reasons to be pissed at her. But she always turned life into a play. She was a mother portrayed by an actor. When I told my wife the ice chip story, she said, Hey, I'm on your mother's side with this one. You can choke to death on ice. Your mother was trying to save your life." I scoffed, but then did an internet search and learned that an ice cube can strangle you if it's large enough and blocks the airway. Then it becomes a race. Will that ice cube melt and slide free before you suffocate? I told my wife what I'd learned, and she smiled and said, "Now you're racing against the ice. Will you forgive your mother before you die?" Chapter 99, Next Door to Near Death. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in heaven. I think afterlife is only a pretty way of saying death. But in December 2015, when I was lying anesthetized on the surgery table in Seattle's Harborview Medical Center, with my skull cut open so the neurosurgeon could remove a small benign tumor, I dreamed myself in a wild grass field and saw my dead parents standing on the cliff above me. Depressed and angry most of their lives, my mother and father were magnetically joyous. They held hands. I don't recall seeing them ever holding hands in life. I knew I was dreaming. I have endured monstrous nightmares most of my life, so I've learned many strategies for consciously escaping from subconscious dreams. But I didn't want to escape that dream of my late parents. In fact, as the sun rose behind them and above me, I felt the strong desire to climb that cliff and join them. I would later learn, after my successful surgery, that my brain had bled so much that I needed 4 units of transfused blood and 2 units of platelets. I'd bled so much because the tumor had adhered to my dura mater, the tough membrane between the skull and brain. My dura mater had also adhered to my skull. And most serious, my tumor had grown into and adhered to the superior sagittal sinus, a rather large blood vessel running across the top of my brain. Despite multiple CAT and MRI scans of my skull, the doctors had not seen the extent of these adhesions. So when they'd cut into my head and removed the skull plate, usually the simplest part of any brain surgery, they were surprised to discover they'd also torn open the dura mater and sinus. It sounds terrifying, I know, but I was never in critical condition. It was relatively serious, but I was never near death. I'd only been next door to death, or maybe even down the block and around the corner from death. So I didn't have a near-death experience. Even though I was unconscious, I think I knew my brain was bleeding. I think I heard and felt the increased tension in the operating room. I think I was scared. And to comfort myself, I created the image of my late parents looking at me. Or rather, I'd created alternate parents. A mother and father who offered illuminating love and support instead of fear, doubt, and sadness. It worked. I enjoyed my dream, and I feel warm now as I write about the parents I'd imagined to replace my lost ones. So yes, when it comes down to it, I comforted myself during surgery. I've always been good at comforting myself. Of course, my neurosurgeon stopped the bleeding, removed the tumor, and repaired my brain. I have small titanium plate screws and mesh holding it all together. The doctor told me I wouldn't set off airport metal detectors, but I don't know why not. I don't know anything but the most general details about my surgery. I suppose I could do more research, but I prefer the mystery of medicine and healing. I prefer mystery in almost all things. Near the end of my surgery, I dreamed of my parents again. This time, they were standing in that same grassy field with me. Still holding hands, they stood maybe 50 feet away. They weren't wearing white robes. They didn't have wings or halos. No, they were both dressed in the same clothes in which they'd been buried. My mother's favorite turquoise suit was simply tailored and beautiful. And my father's favorite sweatpants and Geronimo t-shirt looked comfortable and sloppy. They looked like the people I used to know. I waved hello. They smiled, waved goodbye, and walked away through the tall grass. I wasn't sad to see them go. I knew it was time to wake. And so I did. Chapter 100. The Only Time. 4 days after brain surgery, in a private room in Harborview Medical Center, I took a sip of ice-cold water and hiccuped. I laughed. I often hiccuped after my first drink of any icy beverage, just like my late father did. We shared that reflex. Ice cube drink, one big hiccup, laughter, slight embarrassment if it was a public hiccup. That was the routine. But after brain surgery, I hiccuped once, twice, 3 times in a minute, and then I hiccuped for 8 straight hours. Despite all the pain in my life and the large number of tragedies, that was the only time I ever seriously considered suicide. I was almost murdered by hiccups. How hilarious is that? Chapter 101. Scanned. 24 hours after my brain surgery, I met my ICU neurological nurse. Well, I'd met her the day before, but I didn't remember her because I'd been heavily medicated. I was still heavily medicated only a day after surgery, but I felt like I was mostly living in reality. "Didn't you say something about being a fan of mine?" I asked her, needing as much external validation as possible. I had never felt more vulnerable in my adult life, and I was probably also feeling post-traumatic effects from the brain surgeries I had in my early childhood. Yeah, my current brain surgery was reminding me of my previous brain surgeries. "I read your first book of poems my freshman year of college," the nurse said, "and I have read everything since." "That's cool," I said. "Thank you." I felt happy, safer. I figured that a person who loved my words would, by association, also love my brain, and would therefore pay special attention to me. "I'll never tell anybody you are my patient," she said. "Doesn't the law require you to protect my privacy?" I asked. "Yes," she said, "HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. But I won't even tell my husband you are my patient. I won't tell my dogs." "HIPAA protects me," I said, "but I'm a writer, and I don't think there's anything that protects you from me. You're going to appear in my poems and stories, well, the real you and the fictional version of you." "Just make me awesome," she said. "In some future book, I'm going to blend you with another fan," I said. She loved my movie Smoke Signals and wouldn't date any guy who didn't love it as much as she did. "I don't like that movie that much," she said. "It's so much tamer than your books. Too tame." "See there," I said. "You're already becoming fictional." "But based on real events," she said. "Inspired by something resembling the truth," I said. "Sounds like we're both protected," she said. "Yes," I said. "But can I ask a favor?" "What favor?" "I'm going to be stoned on painkillers and other drugs for days and days, right?" "Yes." "And I have brain trauma from the surgery, right? No matter how well everything went." "Yes." "So with all the pain and painkillers and all the damage, I am going to forget things I say and do." "Yes." "So if I say something really good, something sad or funny or smart, then can you write it down? Remember it in case I can't?" "Wow," she said. "I don't know if I can write it down." "HIPAA rules?" "Yes, HIPAA." "But isn't monitoring my behavior part of your job?" I asked. "Yes, it is," she said, and smiled. "Why are you smiling?" I asked. "Something funny happened right after surgery yesterday." "What, what?" I asked. "Tell me. I need you to tell me the story so I can tell the story later." "Okay, okay," she said. "Right after surgery, we took you into the MRI to check that everything looked good in your brain." "Did it look okay?" I asked. "Yes, everything was cool," she said. "And you were talking and..." She hesitated. "What, what?" I asked. "You were being funny and smart right away," she said. "You were verbally coherent even though you were still so drugged up." "What did I say?" "You were flirting with everybody," she said, "calling everybody beautiful and hot." "Oh, no," I said. "I wasn't being a creep, was I?" "No, no, you were very sweet. You were also talking about your beautiful wife, and you were flirting with the men and the women. I think you flirted with yourself and with the MRI machine, too." "Oh, God, that's so embarrassing." "There's more," she said. "There's more." "I don't know if I want to hear anything else," I said. "No," I lied. "I want to hear all of it." "Okay, so when we lifted you from your gurney onto the MRI machine, your operating gown slipped off and you were completely naked." I laughed at the nude predicament that I could not remember being in. "So you were naked," she said, "and you were apologizing. You kept saying sorry to all of us." "Wait, how many people were there?" "8 of us." I laughed and laughed. "So many people," I said. "It was like I was putting on a show." Yeah, you wouldn't stop apologizing, and we're all trying to calm you down, saying, it's okay, we've seen it all before. And then you said, oh no, what, I asked. You pointed at me, she said. Then you told everybody I was a big fan of your books. And then you pointed at your nudity and said you didn't want to disappoint your loyal reader, me. You wanted to make sure we all knew you were a grower and not a shower. My nurse and I laughed together. I had worried about the size of my dick only an hour after brain surgery. Of course I did. Then you got all quiet, she said, and put your hands over your privates and yelled, HIPAA! 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 My nurse and I laughed harder and harder until I thought I might bust the stitchings in my skull. And that's when we started calling you the unicorn, she said. Because of no, not because of your penis, she said. Because you were talking so well after surgery. Because you recovered so fast. Because you and your brain were magical like a unicorn. So my dick isn't magical, I asked. Oh, God, no, she said. I'm a nurse, Sherman. There is nothing magical about anybody's dick. My nurse and I laughed often during my 3 days in the ICU. I didn't know if I would ever see her again. Considering the state of my brain at the time, I didn't think I would recognize her again. But I thought she would listen to this book. I hoped she would listen to this book. Dear nurse, thank you for your honesty and humor. Thank you for taking care of me. Thank you for doing your job so gracefully. Thank you for remembering my stories when I could not. Chapter 102, Brain Surgery Ping Pong. 3 months after brain surgery, I played ping pong and found myself unable to adjust to the speed of the game. I could only follow the ball for one shot at a time and couldn't anticipate my next move or where my opponent might hit it next. I wondered what that might mean about my brain and its new normal. I had noticed those gaps in other ways, how I forgot an interviewer's question 5 seconds after I began to answer. How I stood on stage in front of 3,000 people in Minneapolis and for a brief, terrifying moment, forgot why I was there. In the neurosurgery ICU, the nurse told me they had to be extra diligent when assessing the brain health of imaginative people like me. She said, "You're the ones who can talk your way around your deficiencies." And I said, "I've been talking my way around my deficiencies since I was born." So, playing ping pong, I tried to work around my sudden deficiencies, but I missed and lost and missed and lost. I didn't tell my friends what I was feeling because I didn't want to ruin the fun or make excuses. My friends would have beaten me even if my brain were fully healthy. And I was in no danger. My neurologist said it would take at least a year for my brain to fully heal. So this is who I am now. A lesser ping pong player. That's hardly a tragedy. I played as well as I could. And I sometimes hit good shots. And I was having fun, even as I recognized that I had lost a little of that connection between my eyes and hands. But haven't I been losing shit all along? As we age, don't we all deteriorate? If I can't hit as many smashes in table tennis or swish as many jump shots in basketball or write as many poems as I did before brain surgery, then so be it. I am alive. I am alive. I am alive. And felt even more alive when my friends and I switched from ping-pong singles to doubles. Playing with a teammate, we alternated hits, and I was fucking overjoyed to realize that I had enough time, another second or two, between shots to recharge, to refresh, 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 and put my paddle on the ball with more accuracy and power. But I still didn't say anything about my ping-pong dilemma or my ping-pong epiphany to my friends. I knew I would tell them later through a poem. And this is their poem. Dear friends, I am often a lonely man, even in a room full of people who love me. Dear friends, my brain, unpredictable as it was, is even more unpredictable now. But thank God for all of the ways in which we compensate for our deficiencies. In order to play ping pong, in order to make it through this crazy life, I needed somebody to step in and take the next shot. So let's call this a ping pong prayer. Let's call it a ping pong jubilation. I am not alone in this world. 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 I will never be alone, my friends. And as long as I am alive to be your teammate, neither will any of you. Chapter 103. Clarification. Let me repeat. Yes, I have repeated myself. Yes, I have been repetitious. That's what grief is. Grief and repeat were sitting on the fence. Grief jumped off. Who was left? Repeat. Grief and repeat were sitting on the fence. Grief jumped off. Who was left? Let me repeat the chorus. Let me make things clear. 5 months after my mother died of cancerous tumors, I underwent surgery to remove a benign tumor from my brain. The doctors tell me there's a 10 to 20% chance I will grow other benign brain tumors. Depending on the location and size of those tumors, I could find myself in mortal danger. Did you know that you can be killed by a benign tumor? Imagine that news headline. Native American poet killed by oxymoron. Chapter 104. Words. 10 months after brain surgery, my neurological ICU nurse greeted me after my poetry reading in a tiny theater at Bumbershoot, a music and arts festival in Seattle. I didn't recognize her until my wife said, "Sherman, this is blank. She was your ICU nurse after brain surgery." I vaguely remembered her face, but I specifically remembered her kindness. I hugged her. Then I stepped back. I felt so shy. She'd seen me at my most vulnerable. She'd seen me unarmored and afraid. She'd seen me in the worst pain of my life. She'd seen me weeping and tightly holding my skull because I thought it was burning and bleeding and breaking apart. Standing in that tiny theater, I felt the urge to run away and hide. And then I realized I was still holding my nurse's hand. And that made me even more embarrassed. I dropped her hand and took another step back. "Oh God," I said, "it's so good to see you. I'm sorry I didn't remember your face, but I remember you. Does that make sense? I remember your spirit, but not your face." She laughed and said, "It's okay. You were on so many drugs." I laughed and said, "I love those drugs." She said, "I remember how happy you were to be alive when you woke up, but you were even happier to have your stories intact. You just kept saying, I still have my words. I still have my words. I don't remember much about you, I said, but I remember feeling safe. I felt so safe with you. That's the best thing a patient has ever said to me. I hugged her again. I remembered her scent,